Welcome to the opening public lecture, which is part of the Cultures of Consumption research program. I am Frank Trentman of Birkbeck College, the director of the program. Like these public lectures, the new research program is made possible by the generous support of both the Economic and Social Research Council and the Arts and Humanities Research Board. And the aim of the program is to study consumption in a global context, from the fashionable West End to drug consumption in East Africa. And there will be an opportunity for you to meet some of our wonderful researchers at the reception after the lecture. Cultures of Consumption is the first program, in fact, that brings together the arts and humanities and the social sciences in this way. And the public lectures, I hope, will illustrate the merit of this dialogue. But they're also intended as an interface between academic thought and the widening public debate about consumption. And so in the next 9 months, the public lectures will offer a monthly forum to think about pertinent economic, cultural, as well as political questions, ranging from children as consumers to credit card debt, from food to fashion, and from sustainability to public services. Consumerism and consumer society continue to be key terms in this political debate. And to come to terms with current problems of consumption, it may therefore be helpful to start by asking what is meant by consumer society and where this preoccupation with consumer society came from. I'm therefore delighted to introduce as the first of our leading British and international experts, John Brewer, now Professor of History and Literature at Caltech in LA. Few have done more to change the way we think about consumer revolutions in modern history, most recently in his prize-winning The Pleasures of the Imagination. And none, I think, will be more interesting to hear to help us place the birth of consumer society in a critical, long-term perspective. After the lecture, we shall have the added benefit of two commentators, Jeff Krosik of the AHRB and Madeleine Bunting of The Guardian, who will kick off discussion. There will then be time for questions from the floor, after which you'll be invited to a small reception next door. One final housekeeping matter. On behalf of the Royal Society, who provides the venue, I want to apologize for any noise that might be caused by vital repairs of their air handling unit. Who said that Work Society was dead? Likewise, I would ask you to switch off your mobile phones. Ladies and gentlemen, John Brewer on the error of our ways.
Before I start, a couple of preliminary comments. First of all, a word of thanks to Frank, not only for inviting me to give this lecture, but also for the conversations that we've had over the last few months that have helped me get my way back into a lot of the consumption literature with which I was involved some years ago. And secondly, a word of apology or warning. This talk is intended for a general audience. I know there are many experts. I can see many experts in the audience, and I hope that you will therefore bear with me in the parts of my talk that may reflect on your own area of expertise, because they may seem rather general, because the topic that I take today is a rather large and capacious one, which covers a considerable amount of ground. So, my talk this evening focuses on the debate about the origins and development of so-called consumer society, a discussion not only amongst historians, but commentators on the nature of modernity and postmodernity. I want to tease out the sometimes complex relationship between the emergence of a historical debate about the birth and development of consumer society, which began in the 1980s, and social and political commentary on consumerism from the 1950s onwards. So let me make clear from the outset what I'm not doing. First and foremost, it's not my concern to pass judgment on consumer society or on consumerism. In my view, far too much discussion on these topics takes the form of a panegyric or a jeremiad. One of the most difficult tasks for those who want to analyze consumption in its varied forms, including consumerism, is to get beyond this debate and to avoid becoming an interested party in it. This is not to preclude, of course, serious investigation of the causes, effects, and politics of certain consumption practices. It's just to say that talking about them in the abstract terms of consumer society doesn't seem, for reasons that I'll indicate, to be very illuminating or helpful. Now, in the 1980s, and as part of a larger interest in consumption that involved most of the social science disciplines, though not economics, historians turned their attention to the history of consumer society and consumer cultures. This new scholarship had two chief points of focus: the late 18th century, the eras of the Industrial Revolution, and the period between the late 19th and early 20th centuries. The former literature was concerned with the birth of a consumer society and its relationship to economic growth, the latter with mass consumption and modern retailing in Europe and North America. The trend was embodied in two works: one, The Birth of a Consumer Society, to which I contributed; the other, The Culture of Cultures of Consumption, edited by two young American historians, Richard Fox and Jackson Lears. But the debate soon spread far beyond those two texts. From the outset, this literature was concerned with the origins and development of something that was considered modern. The search for consumer society was a search for modernity, and the emphasis, whether on 18th century acquisitiveness or the late 19th century department store, was on the first signs of what in its maturity was to be considered a full-blown modern consumer society. Now, nowhere was this more apparent than in my co-author Neil McKendrick's provocative thesis that there was a consumer revolution in the late 18th century that gave birth to the first consumer society in Britain. This revolution, he argued, took the form of the greater enjoyment than ever before of material possessions, especially pottery, textiles, and metal goods, produced for and sold in the marketplace. It was made possible, he claimed, by greater wealth, which was more equitably distributed than in other nations, and by the existence of a society which was more open and less formally stratified than elsewhere in Europe. These circumstances affecting demand, he argued, were complemented by shrewd entrepreneurship, marketing, and advertising strategies exemplified in the practices of industrialists like Josiah Wedgwood, the pottery magnate. And central to this account was the role of emulation, particularly middle-class emulation of the aristocracy, and the consequent efforts at social distinction pursued by the aristocratic elite. The social system in this account was not only graded and ordered through emulation, but was driven by it. This impulse or desire was the steam in the economic machine. Now, though immediately subject to severe criticism from outside the discipline of history, the effect of the claims of the birth of consumer society among historians was to launch a plethora of studies which claimed to locate the date and site, the time and place of the birth of consumer society. Now, though the explanation for this historical preoccupation is complex, one of the main motives for this growing literature was a mixture of national pride and field chauvinism. The birth of consumer society was spotted in late 17th century and early 18th century Britain and America, in 16th, 15th, and even 13th century England, in Renaissance Italy, the 17th century Netherlands, 18th century France, and even more improbably, in 18th century Russia. Of course, for those whose focus was on the 19th and 20th centuries and who saw consumer society in terms of mass consumption and the end to a regime of needs for a majority of citizens, such views were a distraction from the radical shift which heralded modern consumer society. But for the most vehement proponent of the birth of consumer society thesis, there was a definite continuum. There are all these naturalistic metaphors that McKendrick uses all the time. To speak of a birth, writes McKendrick, indicates the organic nature of the whole development and the need for a long preceding period of growth and the necessity for many further stages before the maturity of, quotes, a society of high mass consumption would be reached. The impression was of a continuous progression from the 18th century to the present. This, despite the fact, for instance, that the percentage of GNP devoted to consumer expenditure declined by 20% between 1880 and 1959. Well, I want to put McKendrick's formulation under more severe scrutiny, but before I do so, before I engage in this act of fratricide, I also want to point to the significant gains and findings prompted by this historical research on the origins of consumer society. For although, as it will be clear, I see the quest as misguided, like many misplaced actions, it has had unintended good consequences. First, the research that followed in the wake of the birth of a consumer society radically increased our knowledge of the material environment of societies in the past. Though the pattern and precise chronology might vary according to class, wealth, gender, and region, studies of the Netherlands, colonial America, 17th and 18th century Britain, and 18th century France, based on tax records, business records, and above all, inventories of possessions at death, have all revealed a common pattern in which household goods, furniture, new fabrics, looking glasses, clocks, glassware, and pottery, as well as certain kinds of new clothing, became more abundant. There was clearly a much denser environment of manufactured goods than had earlier been supposed. And this growth in durables was matched by an important change in the consumption of such colonial perishables as tea, sugar, and tobacco as items of mass consumption, defined in this literature as being used by 25% or more of the adult population regularly. Much was learned about the world of goods, though much more is known about their presence than about the processes by which they were made, distributed, and consumed. But secondly, the one area in which this issue of process was most extensively examined was in the field of marketing and retailing. A 1759 government survey of shops in England and Wales revealed that Napoleon was right. There were nearly 138,000 retailing establishments, a density of 42 people per shop, nearly double that in the mid-20th century England or the United States. Studies of 18th century retail outlets show that not all were, as these figures might imply, small shops, but that a variety of shops, including arcades and large emporia, existed long before the famous 19th century department store. Third, during the 18th century, as part of a larger debate about trade and the economy, a body of analysis emerged that rejected the long-standing moral condemnation of excessive commodity consumption, so-called luxury rather than necessity. Occasionally, as in the case of Bernard Mandeville, this entailed a robust defense of luxury itself as the engine of the economy. In other instances, it pointed to the importance of the provision of what Adam Smith called decencies, items discussed by McKendrick, and revealed in the inventory analyses, that seemed to be neither luxuries nor necessities. Fourth and finally, the greater density of goods enables society's middle ranks, as well as the aristocracy, to shape a labile and changing social identity through the consumption of certain cultural artifacts and services. Notions of gentility, of politeness, of respectability, of comfort, and of gender, femininity and masculinity were at least in part fashioned by particular patterns and practices of consumption. Now, of course, because much of this research has been fueled by its search for the origins of modernity, it frequently offers a very partial view, one that privileges practices that look modern and overlooks those that seem traditional. Thus, there's remarkably little in this literature, with the exception of the work on foodstuffs, about what we might call ordinary consumption. There's almost nothing about non-modern forms of consumption and exchange, such as barter and street markets or peddlers and chapmen, though work on this has begun. And there's very little about forms of consumption outside the marketplace, though more and more research, mostly by feminist historians and historians of women, examines the complex affective relations of memory, nostalgia, kinship, propriety and thrift between people and material objects, not all of which were acquired through the marketplace. Historical research into the early history of consumption, the same is true of the literature investigating the late 19th and early 20th centuries, has tended to split apart into two main areas of investigation which are not very easily connected. The first is economic, quantitative, and primarily concerned with the density of goods, the sheer numbers of commodities, and the connection between consumption and growth. The second is more cultural, anthropological, qualitative, and concerned with issues of identity, subjectivity, and social distinction. Each approach, as we will see shortly, draws upon and corresponds to one of the first two phases in the 20th century debate about consumer society. The first comes out of the Cold War debate about mass consumption and growth of the 1950s and 60s, The second draws on the neoliberal and postmodern debates about consumption, choice, and identity that became prominent in the 1980s. So the historical literature of the 1980s therefore appeared at the very moment at which the debate about consumer society was changing. Yet both sorts of historical inquiry have shared, as I shall try to show, a common concern to identify an archetypal or typical consumer, the embodiment, both individual and collective, of the consumer society. Now, I don't want here to rehearse the debates among historians about the 18th century consumer revolution, though I can bore you with that if you want later. But I do want to emphasize that the discussion has been characterized by a persistent tension between a desire to study consumption, an investigation of how people in the past used up, consumed the world, not just its material objects, but its time, space, and social relations, and a search for the origins of consumerism, the acquisitive purchase of goods in the marketplace by an individual choosing consumer. The two, it goes without saying, are not the same. One is found in all societies, the other only in certain sorts of society. One covers a whole range of social activities and their relation to the material world. The other focuses on the moment of purchase or acquisition in the marketplace. Perhaps we might say that one of the central questions, not well dealt with in this historical literature, is what has been the changing relationship between consumerism and consumption? Now, I want to ask at least two questions of this historical literature. The first has to do with what we might call the signs of modernity that I've identified. A world of goods, sophisticated retailing, public controversy over the virtues and vices of commodity consumption, and the use of goods in identity formation. Why not treat the presence of all of these in the past to question or interrogate the ways in which we've equated certain aspects of consumption with modernity? But because the concern of this historiography has been to say, look, we were the first. It goes on and on. We were the first. My period, that's where it happened. No such critical commentary has been forthcoming. The object is simply to extend modernity back into time, flattening out our sense of the distinctiveness of different historical periods. It's as if we want to invert Bruno Latour's wonderful controversial thesis of, you know, the book called Of We Have Never Been Modern, with something like a formulation, we have always been modern. And one reason why consumer society gets pushed back further and further in time is because of our expectations about traditional or pre-modern societies. We're all very nostalgic. We fantasize about a pre-lapsarian Edenic world where men and women had simple needs, not complex wants, related to objects functionally rather than through irrational desire, and enjoyed a coherent and stable rather than fragmented and labile sense of identity. When we look back into the past and find instead what I call signs of modernity, we see first consumerism and then consumer society. But, and this is my second question, how do we get from acts of consumption or consumerism to consumer society? As Ben Fine, one of the most persistent and telling critics of this literature, has pointed out, the tactic, in which often one swallow really does make a summer, involves what he calls a horizontal understanding of consumption. I quote, whatever factors are taken to be of importance, he means in an individual case, are presumed to apply generally across the economy or society as a whole. If it works like this for pottery or automobiles, then it works like this in consumption as a whole. In fact, much of the literature on early modern consumption, and this is also true of its 20th century equivalent, involves synecdoche, in which the part stands for the whole. The case for a consumer society moves from acts of consumption to the existence of historical actors called consumers, to the presence, therefore, of a consumer society. Now, the inevitability of this progression seems to me to be highly questionable. It may happen, it's not necessary. As Frank Trentman has pointed out in a couple of recent essays, I don't think they're published yet, are they? No. One of the most interesting features of the early modern period is the way in which consumption practices do not lead to any sort of consumer consciousness. Consumption was recognized as socially and economically beneficial, of course, and Adam Smith famously wrote in The Wealth of Nations that, I quote, consumption is the sole end and purpose of all production, and the interest of the producer ought to be attended to only so far as it may be necessary for promoting that of the consumer. The maxim is so perfectly self-evident that it would be absurd to prove it. And in fact, Smith doesn't really say anything very much about consumers after that. But consumers, or the consumer, were largely absent from 18th century Scottish political economy, which, as Trentman rightly says, is concerned not with consumer society, but commercial society, and not with consumers, but merchants and traders. The universal man, as it were, is the trading man, the exchanging man, not the consuming man. Even when acts of consumption, or more usually acts of abstinence from consumption, were used, as in the American Revolution and in the anti-slavery movement, to political ends, they were not undertaken on behalf of or by consumers, but by those who gave themselves a political or moral designation. The consumer is a political actor, or as a category of person who needed protection or had interests, had to await the 19th century. And this seems to me a very fundamental difference between the two periods. Consumption practices may have been economically, socially, and culturally important and changing, but, and this is the general point that the historical case illustrates, even so, they do not necessarily produce consumer consciousness, the emergence of the consumer as a historical agent. Now, if leaping from acts of consumption to consumer consciousness is a non-starter, what about the move from acts of consumption to consumer society? There's been a tendency in the historical literature to assume that the definition of consumer society is self-evident, or that it's a thing, that there is a thing rather than a construct, with a series of characteristics, namely disposable and discretionary income for a significant number of people, availability of goods that permit consumer choice, the practice of self-fashioning through goods often understood as a desire for the new novelty and fashion that can be checked off like items on a shopping list. In fact, most definitions of consumer society do consist of, or at least include, or depend highly on, a shopping list. It is more often than not defined by the density of things, furnishings and fabrics in the 18th century, cars, televisions, household appliances in the mid-20th. In much of this literature, the presence of goods and commodities overshadows the presence of the consumers themselves. For it's the plenitude of goods, rather than the plethora of consumers, that conveys the sense of abundance with which consumer society is so often associated. It's the consumed good, rather than the consumer, who speaks in this story. In all such accounts, there's a gap between consumer practices and the notion of consumer society, one that is more often than not filled by some general characterization of the consumer, which is needed in order to explain why the consumer consumes. In McKendrick's case, he welds Thorsten Veblen to the 18th century luxury debate to produce the emulative consumer. In other accounts of consumer society, we're offered, of course, the manipulated consumer, whose tastes and preferences are given to him or her. This is a favorite of the left from the Frankfurt School critics onwards. Or we have the dreaming, fantasist consumer, often invoked in analyses of the department store. We have the marginal, utility, rationalizing consumer of most economists, and the identity-creating consumer and the resisting consumer found in so much cultural studies literature. The problem is not one of whether or not such consumers were so motivated or understood their actions in that way, although ethnographic studies in which consumers speak for themselves rather than being ventriloquized by pundits and academics almost always reveal a more complex picture, but of making a particular type of consumer speak for all consumers. Thus, most accounts of consumer society come with a stereotypical, ideal-type consumer, and debates about consumer society are therefore almost always debates about consumer identity. But as Fine and Leopold have stressed, given the extraordinary complexity of consumption practices, not only in the present but in the past, and I quote, it's inconceivable that any one general theory of consumption will suffice. Moreover, any interpretation, I have to kind of rhythm of the talk. Any interpretation that moves from the motives of an aggregate of individual consumers to consumer society entails an astonishing myopia. Any remotely plausible account of consumer society cannot overlook the role of institutions, from the firm to the state, the topographies of consumption, questions of access and exclusion, and the complex chains that link production and consumption. Now, such an analysis certainly exists, but its absence from so much of the work debating the existence of a consumer society can best be understood if we turn to a closer analysis of the historical story of the consumer society debate. Now, the term consumer society, as opposed to the term the consumer, or talking about consumption, is a relatively recent coinage. I'm going to be bold and say that the term was not used at all before the late 1950s. If anybody can give me instances, then I'd be very interested to know. And only achieved anything like general usage in the 1960s. Even the American economist George Katona, one of the major early apologists for post-war mass consumption, preferred to speak of a mass consumption society rather than a consumer society. Nevertheless, we can identify three phases of the consumer society debate. The first, between 1950 and 1974, occurred during the so-called golden age of post-World War II growth in Europe and the US, the combined new levels of material abundance and unprecedented leisure time, and it was associated with high disposable incomes, particular consumer goods, especially cars, white goods, domestic appliances and televisions, and in the Anglophone world as well with home ownership. This was a debate about the mechanisms and vices and virtues of capitalist growth in the Cold War. The second phase began in the late 60s but reached its apogee in the early 80s and pitted neoliberals with their preoccupation with the sanctity of individual choice against critics who saw consumer society as one devoted primarily to its own reproduction, what the French situationist Guy Debord described as the society of spectacle, in which, to quote Perry Anderson, economic life itself becomes so pervaded with symbolic systems of information and persuasion that the notion of an independent sphere or a more or less acultural production increasingly loses meaning. The third phase of the debate, which dates from the 1990s, and which I don't have time to discuss this evening, is that about globalization and its effects. Now, from its inception, the term consumer society was not used as an analytic tool, but as a large-scale prescriptive characterization of a social order. Whether we read the panegyrics of Cold War liberals or the jeremiads of often religious social conservatives or hostile commentators on the left, discussion of consumer society was, and to a large extent remains, almost always highly generalized and politically tendentious. Which is perhaps to say that the debate about consumer society inaugurated, indeed it was essentially a debate about the politics of consumption. Now obviously by this I don't mean to say that there was no consumer politics before the end of World War II. On the contrary, at least since the late 19th century, if not earlier, both in Europe and the United States, groups of consumers had banded together as consumers to act as what the Harvard historian, Lisbeth Cohen, has usefully termed citizen consumers, who, I quote, take on the political responsibility we usually associate with citizens to consider the general good of the nation through their consumption. Bodies, that is to say, like the National Consumers League in the US, cooperative movements and guilds throughout Europe, or the British Consumers Association would be examples. And governments, especially those which came to embrace Keynesian economics, also recognized with varying degrees of acceptance that consumers constituted an interest in society along with labor and capital. But as Cohen has shown, in post-war America, a new consensus emerged around a formulation that linked the customer and the citizen, the customer as citizen, the notion that the pursuit of private consumption was in the national or public interest. As Cohen has written, I quote, "For at least a quarter of a century, the idea of the consumer's republic provided the blueprint for American economic, social, and political maturation, as well as for export around the globe. The consumer's republic had many appeals. It promised great prosperity through yoking employment and economic growth to high consumer demand, and it provided a ready weapon in the political struggles of the Cold War, helping the United States to justify its superiority over the Soviet Union. But perhaps most attractive was the way it promised the socially progressive end of greater economic equality without requiring politically progressive means of redistributing existing wealth, the American aversion to taxes." And how this actually played out on the ground is the story of her excellent recent book. But this debate was never a domestic one. The Cold War formulation of economic development was exported in theories that connected growing affluence and the ownership of goods to conceptions of democracy. This sort of argument is well represented in a classic best-selling text of the late 50s and early 60s, Seymour Martin Lipset's Political Man. Lipset saw consumer societies as resistant to demagoguery and dictatorship. He measured democracy not only by education and wealth, but by persons per motor vehicle, numbers of telephones, radios, and newspapers per capita. I quote, "In the more democratic democratic European countries, there are 17 persons per motor vehicle, compared with 143 in the less democratic. In the less dictatorial Latin American countries, there are 99 persons per motor vehicle versus 274 in the more dictatorial." In short, here we see the explicit association of certain sorts of commodity, or the density of certain sorts of commodity, with a particular political regime. In other words, it's during the Cold War that American commodities, the classic case brilliantly used by Stanley Kubrick in Dr. Strangelove, and skillfully deconstructed by Danny Miller in his study of the Caribbean, is of course Coca-Cola, come to represent the American liberal democratic way of life. Consumption, conceived of somewhat unproblematically as ownership rather than use, becomes a key measure of politics. A set of economic and social practices is conflated with a political vision. The appurtenances of modern everyday life become part of what was then a global struggle. So thanks to the efforts of Cold War liberals, the connection between a particular way of life and consumer goods has become naturalized. But we should recognize this conjunction as a historically specific consequence of the ideological struggles of the Cold War, which were sustained in the American case not only by academic scholarship, but by the US Information Agency and the State Department. Now, the debate about the superiority of an American privatized regime of mass consumption connects in many interesting ways with the discussion of late 18th century Britain as the first consumer society. The literature on economic development in the 50s and 60s looked back to the experience of the first industrial nation and its theorists to elaborate its models of growth. Thus, the Stages of Economic Growth, a non-communist manifesto, written by the American economist and Cold War warrior Walt Rostow, which between 1960 and 1972 sold a staggering 260,000 copies in English alone, was an explicit attempt to use British history, I quote, "to the formulation of a wiser public policy to show that the Western model rather than Russian communism was the right way forward for the Third World." Now, this emphasis on the British case was, of course, in part because the object was to refute Marx, whose theory rested on an analysis of the British Industrial Revolution, and to emphasize the benefits of the first takeoff into sustained growth rather than the misfortunes it brought to many, which was why the scholarly debate about the so-called standard of living controversy during the Industrial Revolution was so bitter during the Cold War. Now, Rostow did not, of course, attribute Britain's takeoff to growing demand consumption, though he did see the end of such growth as the arrival of a society of high mass consumption. But he placed great emphasis in his analysis of the British case on what he saw as the most important precondition to successful growth in contemporary transitional societies, namely a flexible and more open political and social regime, with leaders, a sort of liberal vanguard, ready to embrace and encourage a culture of innovation and novelty. These he supposed to be present in 18th century England. So the birth of consumer society thesis connects to and elaborates this analysis. McKendrick explicitly cites Rostow's account, reinforces his view of Britain as an open society, takes a highly optimistic view of the material circumstances of the Industrial Revolution, and drawing on Rostow's conclusion that the age of mass consumption marks the full maturity of economic development, he refigures Rostow's period of takeoff, 1783 to 1802, as the birth of consumer society. Drawing on analyses that saw the strength of contemporary capitalism to lie in the realm of consumption, McKendrick back-projected this into the 18th century. His analysis is sometimes seen as part of the Thatcherite neoliberalism, but its chief reference point is the Cold War debate about the best means to economic growth. Now, the defense of consumerism as a source of growth and growth as the means of consumerism, not, of course, without their critics. In fact, the term consumer society was used more often before it passed into general usage in journalism by its opponents than by those who advocated consumer-led growth. Though there have always been certain conservatives who agonized about the destruction of traditional forms of allegiance and community, the strongest criticisms of consumer society have consistently come from the left. From the critics of mass society, chiefly those German intellectuals in exile in the United States, from the Frankfurt School, and perhaps most notably Herbert Marcuse, from the group of French critics, almost all of whom were associated with the journal Socialisme ou Barbarie, notably Henri Lefebvre, Jean-François Lyotard, Guy Debord, and Jean Baudrillard, and in the Anglophone world by members of the New Left, and also by Now, in the first phase of the consumer society, the debate mirrored pre-war occupations, with preoccupations with mass society, and emphasized the deadening, culturally empty, conformist nature of mass consumption, its creation of false needs by what Perry Anderson has called a streamlined machinery of desire. It focused on the mechanisms and consequences of manipulation by Vance Packard's famous Hidden Persuaders, paying special attention to marketing and advertising in the manufacture of false wants. On the one hand, it recognized the power of consumer desire. On the other hand, it interpreted this as a form of passivity because it was the consequence of false consciousness. Its archetypal consumer was manipulated and deluded, which is why George Katona's bullish The Mass Consumption Society of 1964 was concerned to rebut this view by demonstrating that the American consumer, though not ruthlessly driven by economic rationality, was not given to delusion, but was in fact, I quote, sensible and discriminating. Debate about consumer society was once again a debate about the character or nature of the consumer. While much of the historical literature inspired by the birth of consumer society mirrored the concerns of the first phase of the consumer society debate, the interest in consumer practices and in identity formation grew out of the second phase of the consumer society debate with its neoliberal preoccupation with individual choice and its reconceptualization of consumer society as an overarching, all-embracing, semiotic order. Now, the context for these developments was a new emphasis on flexible rather than mass production, greater distancing, both physical and psychic, between production and consumption, and the focus on forms of consumption that emphasized individuality rather than conformity, and the growing importance of technologies of reproduction and simulation. If the mass society critique that consumption was numbingly conformist had achieved some purchase, and not just on the left, its puritanical sense that consumption beyond basic needs was false, unnecessary, and alienating, came under fire, and not just from free market liberals. Thinking of consumption as a means to produce meaning, as the articulation of signs and symbols, and therefore viewing consumer society as a semiotic system, had two rather contradictory outcomes. On the one hand, there were those who followed the extremely influential work of Michel de Certeau on everyday life, that emphasized that even within the constraints of contemporary capitalism, consumers had agency, could create something with its own meaning, shape their world and identity in their own image. On the other was the view associated particularly with Jean Baudrillard that consumption was totalizing, all-embracing, inescapable, a regime or order whose object was to endlessly reproduce itself. Consumption, he wrote, is neither a material practice, well, that's interesting, nor a phenomenology of affluence. It's not defined by the food we eat, the clothes we wear, the car we drive, nor the visual and oral substance of images and messages, but in the organization of all this as signifying substance. Consumption is the virtual totality of all objects and messages presently constituted in a more or less coherent discourse. Consumption, insofar as it is meaningful, is a systematic act of the manipulation of signs. Well, yes. Consumer society is a semiotic world marked by constant change and permanent stasis. This is not so much a thesis of individual manipulation, as in the critique of the Frankfurt School, as of massive and collective delusion, the source of postmodern resignation and despair. But, once again, we face the same problems that we've seen in every version of consumer society, an archetypal consumer, the maker of signs, and a more general characterization of consumer society bereft of any middle ground. Indeed, the general characterization of consumption as a signing and symbolic practice has had the effect of treating consumption as an almost totally autonomous realm, devoid of economic and social context, of seeing the distancing of consumption from production as in some sense real. The Saussurean notion that the sign has an arbitrary relation is one which enables you to kind of completely sever production and consumption. So what, then, to conclude? If I'm pressed to answer the question, did the late 18th century see the birth of a consumer society, I would have to answer no. But my preferred answer is to say that this isn't a very good question, because it's not a very good way of thinking about either consumption or consumerism in the 18th, 20th, or 21st century. This isn't just because, as I've indicated, of the political freight the consumer society debate has had to carry, that has largely been a none too covert debate about the market and its role in our lives, but because its language, assumptions, and framework, as used by both its apologists and critics, has obscured the middle ground between the individual consumer and some generalized notion of society, and made it difficult to develop what Robert Merton, the sociologist, famously called middle-level explanations. What we need is a much better understanding of the processes which connect forms of production and consumption, studies that attend to consumer politics, both in the sense of the role of regulatory bodies and systems of law, and of consumers acting collectively. A far more subtle and complex understanding of the contested and contradictory meanings of consumption practices, which include the self-understanding of the consumer, and a stronger sense of the relationship and distinction between consumerism and consumption. Now, lest you as an audience find me guilty this evening of delivering the sort of Jeremiah that I've complained about, let me say that I think that these sorts of investigation are already underway, and that thankfully we have begun to move well beyond the consumer society debate. It's always fashionable to be post something, and I just hope that we are post consumer society. Thank you.